then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, a vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man the chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely croon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's Christmas Day, December the 25th, 2013. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, let's start out with a little bit of true Christmas cheer. I've finally been able to get a report on Edgar Steele's situation from inside the gothic walls of the Victorville Maximum Security Prison in California, and it's better than expected. One of our prison guys was transferred to Victorville recently, and he's been able to speak with Edgar, finally. On the downside, Ed is confined to a wheelchair due to recent heart surgery. By all rights, he should never have been sent to Victorville at all. He's pushing 70 years old now, he still has an extremely serious heart condition, and he should either be in the federal prison system's main medical facility in Springfield, Missouri, or else he should be in their geriatric unit at Fort Devens, Massachusetts, which is where the dictatorship sends the old men who are doing 10,000-year sentences to finally die in prison like some insane judge decreed 50 years ago. But Victorville is kind of like a medieval oubliette. It's a hole in the ground into which the dictatorship drops people that they want to disappear. According to our contact, Ed now has long hair, and although he's in a wheelchair, he is coherent and as cheerful as can be expected under the circumstances. Apparently, the rumors about him having had some kind of mental breakdown are not, repeat, not true. Ed is able to conduct a coherent conversation, although he's very easily tired. Also, his captors have withheld his mail for well over a year by placing him in some kind of weird security classification, but apparently they're now letting him have a little of his mail from the past 2 years or so. Ed asked our guy to convey his thanks to me over an article on his situation that I ran in the party's magazine, Northwest Observer, which, as near as I can figure, was over a year old. Whether they are allowing him personal letters yet, I don't know. I'll see if I can find out. Ed said that he'd written me a letter thanking me for the article, but that was several weeks ago and I haven't received it yet, so apparently the commandant of the prison is not allowing him to send any outgoing mail still, which is why no one's heard from him for 2 years. No new migrants to welcome this week, but some other good NF news. On Friday morning, I logged on and found not one, not two, not three, not four, but 14, count them, yes, 14 inquiries on the northwestfront.org website from people asking for information about the NF. Now, three of them were in the homeland itself, one was Canadian, and the other 10 were elsewhere in the U.S. Harmonic convergence, I guess. Seriously, I'll be interested to see if this develops into anything, or if it's just some kind of bizarre fluke, or maybe Antifa's faking names and addresses of total strangers. That kind of crap has happened before, and it can have interesting results. Now, I'd like to say at this time that while the purge, or whatever it was, of the party's website links from the internet, which took place last August, still seems to be affecting us, in that we haven't quite recovered our previous high point of 6,000 hits per week, I've noticed a very distinct increase in not only the quantity, but the quality of the responses that we've been getting lately. A lot of intelligent people, including people with prior movement backgrounds, are starting to understand that the Northwest Front is pretty much it for anyone who's serious about securing the existence of our people and the future for white children. And they're starting to ignore all the space madness and get in touch with the party and ask me about these things directly. For example, take the segment I did with Joe Adams on White Voice last week. There was a time not so long ago when that wouldn't have happened, and I've gotten a couple of good responses off that show already. Now, I'll tell you this again, people, although it's very hard for me to be convincing because you guys don't sit where I sit and see what I see, but the mountain really is starting to move. Just a few tremors, to be sure, but it's happening. I think if I can somehow avoid dropping dead on the carpet here, and if the dictator's servants discover that they have more pressing matters to attend to than silencing one old crank with a podcast and a blog, as well they might, then 2014 is going to be a pretty big year for us.
Good afternoon, comrades. Harold recently talked about movement burnout, and I thought I would touch on the subject a bit myself. No, that wasn't the reason I've been missing in action the past couple of months. I've explained the reasons for that in another RFN segment. But it is something I've thought about off and on over the past few months, in some of the far and few between quieter moments I've had. I can see how it could happen not just for old-timers in the movement like Harold or the gentleman he mentioned in that podcast, but also for the people who have been racially aware for a relatively short period of time in the overall scheme of things. It seems to be lately that it's mostly those who are quite new to the movement, Andy for example, who are stepping up and doing what it takes to get themselves here and work toward building the foundations we're going to need to succeed in creating a country of our own. I can see where it could become very frustrating to those who recently became racially aware and have done what needs to be done, to listen to all the excuses and reasons of those who have been in the movement for a long time, but who have basically used it for entertainment. Andy learned about the Northwest Front, acknowledged that it really is the only option the white race has of survival here in North America, and made a commitment to become part of the solution rather than the problem. He moved here within a relatively short period of time after becoming racially aware. Less than 2 years, I believe, and has been active ever since. Now, please understand, I'm not talking about people like Harold and others who have given much of their lives to ensure the survival of our race. I'm talking about those who have claimed for a long time to be part of this movement, who may have sent in some money toward helping the cause on occasion, have certainly enjoyed the publications and podcasts, and may even have shared some of this information with others they felt they could trust. The problem is that these people may never actually have committed themselves to the cause personally, way deep down inside. Why do I say they may not be personally committed? You all know why, if you think about it. I say that because they're not willing to step out of their comfort zone and move here. They're still living outside the Northwest. This is not directed toward those who deeply desire to move here but can't for reasons of immigration laws and other such nonsense placed upon us by the powers that be right now. It's directed at those of you who are citizens of the United States of America and who, at least in theory, have freedom of movement of the country and could move here at any time. No, moving isn't easy, but then I'm not asking any one of you to do anything I haven't done myself. But, you say, you were already living in the Northwest when you became racially aware. It's true, I was. However, I've moved across and up and down this country 7 times for a total of 12,450 miles. Although I had a job lined up a couple of those times, usually I did not, and I always found one in about 2 weeks. In one case, I got the first job I interviewed for 2 days after I arrived and was asked to start that day. One time it took me almost a month, but that was a really tight market. Finding housing when I arrived at my destination was actually one of the easier tasks I faced. So when I say I'm not asking you to do anything I haven't already done, I mean that literally. In many cases, this move will involve uprooting your family and moving to an area of the country you really know nothing about. It means leaving your friends, likely most of your family, your job, your home, everything that is familiar, and much that is precious to you. Trust me, I know how hard that is to do, and how incredibly gut-wrenching it can be. In some ways, moving to the Northwest will be the hardest thing you ever do, because it means changing everything about your life except you. And even you will change if you choose to move. You will find in yourself a courage you may not have known you had, an ability to stick with an incredibly difficult task, which is something most people in this day and age never have to do. If done right, rather than tearing your family apart, as so many fear it will do, it has the potential to bring you closer together, to create the kind of family bond so many dream of but few find today. The potential for greater self-respect and personal growth is immense. Don't make the same mistake I did. I actually didn't contact the Northwest Front for almost a year after I first learned of its existence, partly out of fear and partly because I figured they wouldn't have a use for someone like me, that I was so small and insignificant it wouldn't matter one way or another whether they knew I existed or not. Eventually, though, I became tired of being afraid and reached out. I could not have imagined talking to all of you this time 3 years ago, but hey, look at me now. We all matter, every single solitary one of us. It's not too late yet to reach out and contribute to the survival of the white race in a tangible and truly meaningful way. I did. What about you? Hail victory, comrades.
Since we're coming up to Christmas, it's time for our one Christmas story. Now, I've mentioned the story more than once on this program and played this song, but although these events happened 99 years ago, it's one that I think needs to be retold at every Yuletide season, because this falls into the we must never allow ourselves to forget category. World War I was one of the most horrific experiences that Western man and Western civilization has ever undergone. In many respects, it was worse, I think, than World War II, because it came at the end of almost a century of virtually unbroken peace and prosperity and economic and cultural growth in Europe and here in America. Now, sure, there were a few hiccups, like the Franco-Prussian War, but basically for almost 100 years, everything was on an even keel, pretty much, and the white man was free to be all that he can be, especially in such places as Germany, Great Britain and her colonies, and here in America. One of the saddest stories in history, I believe, is the story of the Christmas Truce of 1914. Now, this occurred on Christmas Eve, 5 months into the war, when men on both sides of the trenches stopped fighting and held spontaneous Christmas celebrations instead. No official ceasefire was declared, but more than 100,000 British, French, and German troops participated in the unofficial truce along the length of the Western Front. The truce began with Christmas carols. The German troops had put candlelit Christmas trees on the trench parapets in many places along the front, and at 11 o'clock, which was midnight in Berlin, many of them began to sing Stille Nacht, Silent Night. The British soldiers listened and then responded with carols of their own. And then the soldiers started shouting Christmas greetings to each other across the barbed wire, and from there it went on to general comments and conversation, which was possible because in some cases those damn trenches were so close that it was actually possible to communicate over the distance. Now, gradually, men on both sides of the trenches put down their weapons and started spontaneous Christmas celebrations. Their officers ordered the men to keep shooting, but the truce spread all up and down the front lines. Men climbed from the trenches to shake hands in no man's land. They shared food packages from home, traded gifts and souvenirs such as buttons and hats, and they ate and drank together. On Christmas morning, soldiers again sang Christmas carols, and signboards dotted the trenches. Since more German soldiers spoke English than English soldiers spoke German, the signboards were written mostly in English. Sometimes the English was simple, like, "You no fight, we no fight." Men exchanged cigarettes, chocolates, cakes, sausages, and the Germans in one sector even rolled out a barrel of beer into the middle of no man's land to share with the British and the French. The soldiers played football and enjoyed the freedom to move about without danger. The truce also allowed burial parties to safely retrieve recently fallen soldiers and bring them back behind their lines. Both sides held joint services for their fallen comrades. In many sectors, the Christmas 1914 truce lasted through Christmas night, and in others it lasted until New Year's Day. In years to come, the officers on both sides made sure that there was no repetition of the informal truce by ordering huge bombardments all along the Western Front beginning on Christmas Eve that lasted through Christmas Day. This episode has always haunted me because it was probably the last time in history that Germans and Englishmen met as equals and friends. And from then on, the curtain of Jewish propaganda and demonization of the Germans descended, and the poison of it still hangs in the air between Germany and the rest of the world like a gas attack in the trenches. Anyway, in memory of that night and day 99 years ago, when our two peoples last exchanged the hand of friendship without a wall of filthy Jewish lies to divide us, this is Arnie Dormsgaard.
O Tannenbaum, O Tannenbaum, wie treu sind deine Blätter. O Tannenbaum, O Tannenbaum, wie treu sind deine Blätter. Du grünst nicht nur zur Sommerzeit, nein, auch im Winter, wenn es schneit. O Tannenbaum, o Tannenbaum, wie treu sind deine Blätter. Wie falsch ist dein Gemüte, o Mägdlein, o Mägdlein, wie falsch ist dein Gemüte. Du schwurst mir treu in meinem Glück, nun arm ich bin, gehst du zurück. O Mägdlein, o Mägdlein, wie falsch ist dein Gemüte. Wie treu
This is a saying we need to repeat as to why we need secession. God grant me the serenity to accept the things that I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. What we cannot change is the Federal Reserve. Impeach Obama, stop Obama from opening the borders to masses of immigrants, stop the federal government from stealing your money from the banks like they did in Cyprus, and restore any part of the Constitution. The people of America are living in a free speech zone. You can demonstrate all you like, but no one is going to listen to you. We have to have the courage to support the secession of Washington State from the Union and Idaho and Oregon. In the state of Washington, we have a state referendum, and by such referendum, secede from the Union and become a sovereign and an independent nation. We have to have the courage to move to the Northwest and stop all this silly nonsense of thinking we can abolish the corruption that goes on inside the Beltway. About 700 years ago, an Archbishop of Prague visited Rome and said that Rome was the beast of the Revelation. Today, the Seventh-day Adventists are still saying that Rome is the beast of the Revelation, whereas Jehovah's Witnesses are saying that it is the United Nations. However, the European Union building in Strasbourg is a replication of the Tower of Babel. We need to keep our mind open to the idea that there is more than one beast. So whatever we consider to be the beast of the Revelation, we must grant ourselves the serenity to accept the things we cannot change. What did change in history is that an island in the northwest corner of Europe became the center of Protestantism. That island became the British Empire, and the sun never set on the British Empire. The northwest is the beginning of a new Jerusalem. The song sung by the British Nationalist Party is Jerusalem, written by a British Israelite, otherwise known as Christian Identity. We need to change the last words to, "And Jerusalem was builded here, on America's green and pleasant land." And now for something completely different. They have found Pharaoh's chariots on the bottom of the Red Sea. Of course, they have been there for 3,400 years. They crossed between what we now call the Sinai and Saudi Arabia. In our day and age, we can dive down with scuba diving equipment and even send down remote cameras, which are never available before now. Some of the wheels were made of gold. There is an ancient pillar on both sides of the Red Sea where they crossed. The pillars appear to be Phoenician. The Exodus teaches us a lesson. It is time for the white Exodus, the white Christian Exodus to the Northwest. Detroit has gone bankrupt. The waters of the Nile have turned to blood. So how many more miracles do you need to persuade you to get out of Egypt or the East Coast? Are you going to wait until your firstborn is murdered before you start your Exodus? On another front, I hear that the United Kingdom is going to restore conscription, known as the draft. The second reading will be coming up soon in Parliament. Conscription? You've got to be kidding me. So how many Muslims are going to enlist? If the Muslims enlist, England will experience fragging. Fragging means officers being shot in the back by their own soldiers. When it comes to loyalty to one's race and nation, there is no room for political correctness. Soldiering requires an understanding of motives, such as loyalty. Are the British officers from Sandhurst going to be as stupid as the politicians and accept Muslims as loyal soldiers? The Muslims will never be British soldiers. And if they cannot be soldiers, then they cannot be citizens either. It is time for the British officers to do what Oliver Cromwell did to Parliament. Close it down. But did you know that there is only one person and one person alone that can be blamed for reducing England to a cesspit? All bills, before they become law, have to be signed by the Queen. The rubber-stamp Queen has never refused to sign into law a single bill from Parliament.
Okay, this being Christmas Day, I get that most people are going to have a lot better things to do than sit there listening to me bloviate, so rather than get too topical, I'll throw in some filler here from the nutty 90s. No, I haven't forgotten my promise to talk about how to survive as a white boy in an integrated high school, but that'll be for later in the show. Right now, I think I'm going to read an old piece from January of 1997, In other words, almost 17 years ago I wrote this. My God, time flies when you're having fun. It deals with the genuine holiday theme of Jewish ritual murder, the holiday being Passover. Now, this is an email I got from a guy named Richard Green. Hello, all. My name is Rich, and I just recently joined this list. I'm interested in revisionism and open debate on the Holocaust. Does this list engage in open debate on the Holocaust, or did I join the wrong list? Also, I just read about Jewish ritual murder. Do people believe that this is true? Regards, Rich. And I responded as follows. Dear Mr. Green, yes, I do believe that the Jews have practiced ritual murder as part of their religious ceremonies in the past, and that they almost certainly do so today, with the following qualifiers. I do not believe that this practice is, or ever has been, widespread, but has always been restricted to a small number of the most hardcore rabbis and Jewish Kabbalistic mystic sects. I am perfectly willing to accept the likelihood that individual Jews down through history have been falsely accused of this practice, just as I believe that on the other hand, it has often been carried out undetected and or unpunished. The Bylus case in 1913 Russia is a good case in point. Mendel Bylus himself was probably innocent of the actual commission of murder, although he may have been peripherally involved in covering up the act on the part of his co-religionists. I am willing to accept that the overwhelming majority of Jews are unaware that the blood libel has at least a partial grounding in fact, and genuinely do believe it to be a slander, just as most Jews probably believe that the Holocaust occurred, more or less as advertised, despite mounting evidence to the contrary. My belief in the proceeding is based on two foundations: extensive study of the historical, cultural, and religious aspects of Judaism, and my own personal observation, dealings, and experience with the Jews as individual people over a period of 25 years. I don't want this email to get too prolix, since this isn't really my area of enthusiasm. The Jews' public and political crimes are far worse than their private religious ones. But, briefly summarized. Number one, there is an immense amount of anecdotal and circumstantial evidence that these sacrificial homicides took place in the past, back in times when concealment was harder, and Aryans far more aware and wary of the Jew than they are today. It is significant that ever since the days of Babylon, a period of almost 4,000 years, this accusation, like many others, has been leveled against the Jews everywhere they have ever resided in the world. Time and again, down through the ages, the Jews have been caught literally red-handed, in some cases toting the dead body of the child whose blood they've drained away to dispose of it in sacks or wagons, sometimes with the corpse being found in the synagogue's cellars, so forth and so on. The Jews' response to this is, "Vius being persecuted!" They maintain that down through 40 centuries of history, there has been a mammoth conspiracy to frame them for ritual murder. Now, according to this theory, in places as far apart as Cochin China, medieval Germany, 1913 Kiev, and 1970 Montreal, and among peoples as diverse as knightly crusaders, Turkish sultans, 12th century Yorkshire Saxons, Argentinians, Cossacks, British historians, Renaissance Italian popes, assorted saints and sinners, the Burgermeisters of Prague, and modern-day Arabs, there exists one big, long, continuous plot periodically to murder small children, drain them of blood, and plant the bodies on Jewish premises or in Jewish vehicles, etc., etc. Now, that's one hell of a conspiracy. Now, there are other similar complaints that are always leveled against the Jews wherever and whenever they've gone. Economic trickery and despoliation, refusal to assimilate, disloyalty to their host country, arrogant behavior and hatred against their hosts, etc., etc. The Jewish response is always the same. For 4,000 years, everybody in the world has been engaged in a colossal conspiracy to get them. And nowadays, most people believe that, not surprising in view of the Jewish control of the media of communications, which has existed in various strengths in the Western world since the late 19th century. But in the old days, it didn't wash. Now, our medieval ancestors were not fools. They lived with the Jews side by side in close-packed urban communities, very small by modern standards. And they knew the Jews far more intimately than we do today. Just like people today, they cared about their children, and when a child was slain, the entire community interested itself not only for purposes of revenge, but to ensure the safety of everybody else's kids. Now, we are asked to believe that time and again, insular communities who discovered that they had a child killer in their midst stubbornly refused to apprehend the alleged Gentile quote-unquote real killers, and they blamed the Jews out of religious bigotry. Now, what possible interest could any community, medieval or otherwise, have in lynching an innocent scapegoat and allowing a real killer of children to go free? Why would everyone in Trier or Lincoln or Spoleto or Kiev go along with such a miscarriage of justice when doing so put other children at risk? Why, so far as we know, did the child killings cease once the Jews had been punished and usually driven from the community? Number two, the Jewish religion allows for and practices animal sacrifice, per the Old Testament, or the Torah, as they call it, although these customs have been long held in abeyance, and in theory, they apply only to the temple in Jerusalem. There is an entire sect of Kohanim, as they're called in Israel, who practice and train successive generations of rabbis in the techniques of sacrifice, in anticipation of the day when Israel succeeds in wresting the Al-Aqsa Mosque away from the Muslims who've held it for 1,400 years, and they rebuild the temple. Now, the Talmud teaches that non-Jews are goyim, beasts without souls. To a religious Jew, there's no difference between a German or an American or an African and a cow or a horse or a fish. All are lesser non-Jewish forms of life, humanoid or otherwise. And all of them were put there by God to serve and pleasure the Jew. Now, when the Jews claim that they do not practice human sacrifice, they are, by their own weird lights, telling the truth. They don't consider Gentiles to be human beings. And number three, for the past 25 years, I've been in a unique position to observe Jewish behavior and the Jewish character at first hand. Since being a National Socialist, they don't bother to keep their usual variety of masks on with me, and they let all that Talmudic hatred hang out. Anyone who has ever done night duty in a National Socialist headquarters and lifted the telephone for call after call, hour after hour, to hear the crazed, screaming Brooklyn dialect of a Jew driven mad by hatred, spewing a string of profanity in terms of excrement, raving like some demented parrot or monkey totally out of all human control, thus begins wisdom. Anyone who wants to understand the true nature of this light unto the nations need only oppose them in public, and he will soon find out what utterly loathsome beings the Jews are, what vicious and contemptible cowards they are, what potentially deadly serpents they are. But don't take my word for it. Check out the NISCOR playgroups and see for yourself. And by the way, I should add here, NISCOR was one of the first internet pro-Holocaust groups. Anyway, getting back to my 90s rave. See a revisionist post a calm, serious, well-researched comment on some aspect of the Holocaust, and then see the literally hundreds of hysterical, malicious, hateful, filthy, and abusive posts which follow from the little cadre of about a dozen kikes and kike wannabes who go berserk, attacking, vilifying, insulting, and threatening anyone who dares to contradict the self-proclaimed chosen people of God. I won't belabor this any further, but I will close with two points. First off, the Jewish people are entirely capable of practicing ritual murder, and there is an immense amount of historical evidence that they did so. I can't imagine why they would stop now in this day and age when they have the power to conceal their misdeeds and the captive media falsely to portray them as victims. How many of those little children you see on milk cartons have fallen victim to the knives of the rabbis and lie buried in some remote wasteland or were ground up into dog food in some Jewish-owned processing plant? Now, I'm convinced that at least some of our missing children met that fate. Secondly, the Jews deserve everything that has happened to them in the past and everything that's coming to them in the future, especially when the Palestinians finally get their state as a toehold and America finally runs out of money and the New York-Tel Aviv lifeline collapses. I do not question that innocent individuals of Jewish extraction have suffered down through the ages for crimes which they as individuals did not commit. But my people and all of the peoples of the world have suffered far more at the hands of the chosen ones. Now, the Jews are great survivors, got to give them that, like rats and cockroaches. And like rats and cockroaches, I doubt we'll ever get rid of them entirely. But the world is a much smaller place now, global village and all that. It used to be they could just move on to the next golden Medina when they wore out their welcome somewhere else, but they can't do that anymore. Everybody knows about them now, from Uganda to Honolulu, from Rome to Regina. They've run out of trap doors to dodge through and run out of places to run and hide. Their much-vaunted Israel is going to end up as nothing but a death trap. There is a reckoning coming, a reckoning between humanity and the Jewish people, which will cause the very heavens to darken and the very devils in hell to hide their faces in shock and terror. Now, you might say we owe them a Holocaust. We've been paying their bill for 50 years, and at some point, we're finally going to get what we've paid for. And when that day comes, who knows, even I might pity them. Nah. Every year, I'm a little uncertain what to play for our Christmas program because by the time Christmas Day rolls around, we have all heard virtually every single Christmas carol in the American repertoire 10,000 times. I even considered just playing Burl Ives singing Holly Golly Christmas on here just to fit in with all the Muzak. Of course, you guys would probably lynch me if I did. What I have chosen to play is something called Tala Chrysotis, and I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. It's a very old Christmas carol. It's in Scottish Gaelic, and the singer here is, I believe, named Kemper Clark. And he begins in Scottish Gaelic and then sings the next verse in English, so forth and so on. Anyway, this may be a little esoteric for some of you, but at least it's not Holly Jolly Christmas.
Magel magra es mujaltu muenta suris mevniastu mama kanalien kutaktu kan fui mi fena vida gel magel ansula shelas bla Magel an kritha lindlegra Geris lana togun ke Islian murvata urta fas Alleluia
loving hearts with wisdom. came, a tender, helpless, tiny babe with boundless gifts of grace.
Right. Last week I began answering an email that I received from a young man called Jake in Ohio on how I survived 3 years in an integrated high school and how he can hopefully survive and with a little luck get the hell out of there in better shape than I did. I gave him a few tips on things like how to navigate hallways full of niggers, so forth and so on, but I'll try to get into the subject in a little more depth this week. Now, I know this sounds like an odd topic for a Christmas show, but then in view of the existential crisis our race is facing, I don't think we can afford to feel very Christmassy until Santa brings white people our own country here in the Northwest for Christmas. The problem with Christmas and New Year's is that on the morning of January 2nd, it's always back to the same old liberal happy horse shit. Now, I want to preface my remarks tonight with the same disclaimer I made last week. My own experience is almost half a century out of date. And as horrific as Chapel Hill High School was for me, I understand that it was a walk in the park compared to what some white kids are going through today. Not only are today's niggers more aggressive and violent, not only are the drug problems far worse today, but kids today have also got Mexicans and buggery and neo-Stalinist left-wing school administrations armed with high-tech surveillance technology and the will to use it thrown into the mix, as well as such charming things as zero tolerance for racism policies, police on hand on campus to arrest so-called racial troublemakers, and in some cases a campus culture that resembles something out of Orwell's 1984, complete with two-minute hates directed against Republicans and other wicked evil racists. Remember, in the past few weeks, one of these schools had a 6-year-old white boy arrested and charged with sexual harassment for kissing a little girl during play period, and they had a 5-year-old arrested for making a gun sign with his hands out on the playground. Now, if that's elementary school, God knows what it's like in high school. All of this is combined with genuinely dangerous marauding gangs of Mungoids and mestizos, so anything I say you need to take into consideration more as a historical curiosity than anything else, but here goes. Anyway, Jake, a couple of things to bear in mind. First off, in case no one told you, like they did me when I entered 10th grade, high school is where your permanent record in life begins and things start to stick with you. Now, you get tagged as a racist, a homophobe, a sexual harasser, or any kind of politically incorrect, stroppy white boy in high school, and it can screw you up for life. It can adversely affect your college admission, assuming your parents haven't been so badly ruined by the Obama Depression that you still have plans to go. And going to the wrong college or not going at all can in turn screw you up for the rest of your mortal existence. It will make it impossible for you to ever get or participate in any government contracting job or get any kind of patronage from the Democrats. Now, these days, the system is designed that way. The Democrats want to begin weeding out white boys whose minds are not completely under control and make sure that they are forever marginalized, isolated from the mainstream of American life, and that white boys can never accumulate enough wealth and position themselves so as to be a threat to one-party rule. Now, this applies mostly to boys, since they hope to turn white girls into dykes or race-mixing sluts with black and Mexican boyfriends, who will troop to the polls and vote Democrat like they're told to when they turn 21. But everything I say here applies to girls as well, because a single wrong word let slip and overheard can ruin a girl for life as well as a boy. Now remember, they came after Paula Deen almost 30 years after she said nigger. So, much more so than in my day, you need to think before you act, Jake, and most especially think before you speak, because from now on you're speaking for the record. Okay, second thing to remember. Somehow, in the midst of all the madness and the violence and the cackling Animal House behavior, you have to get yourself an education that will in some way, shape, or form lead to your leaving school with a marketable skill. Something that you can do, preferably with your hands, that involves fixing the rich man's toys when they break. Now, this is the one thing that white males can still do and always will be able to do far, far better than anyone else. And the empowered liberals and niggers know it. No other race, black or brown or yellow, is as mechanically inclined as white people, especially white males. As in modern-day South Africa, most of the ruling Kaffirs and communist Jews have sense enough to understand that they need white scientists and technicians and engineers and machinists and repairmen and craftsmen to fix their toys and keep their infrastructure intact, to keep their cars and computers and air conditioners and televisions running, to keep the toilets flushing and the water flowing through their pipes, to keep electricity in the sockets and keep the highways from crumbling away and the bridges from collapsing. Although as the grid ages and nothing is invested in updating it, that last is going to get harder and harder. One thing I will advise you, Jake, take auto shop. Now, that's one thing I wish to hell I had done. Remember, those who don't know anything about cars and computers are at the mercy of those who do. And those who can fix cars and computers can set up a shade tree business off the books anytime, anywhere. Now you need to figure out what you're good at and somehow get yourself properly educated so that you can do something like this, or at least move on to a technical school that will teach you without all kinds of political crap on your record about being a racist or a misogynist or a homophobe so you never get in. I say again, think. I recommend that you not do what I did, and don't be constantly jamming yourself up by making grand but pathetic little gestures of defiance that no one cares about and which the world will never understand because the world will never be allowed to know about it. Now, there is a corollary to that. Don't dick off in school. Don't give up in despair and start cutting every class or just playing the whole thing for laughs, as tempting as that will be. You have got to make that graduation with a plan of some kind and walk off that stage in your cap and gown with something besides a piece of sheepskin that everybody knows is useless and meaningless in your hand. The Irish have a saying, a man without a plan is a pig. You need to begin knowing what you're up against. Your goal in life for these 3 and sometimes 4 years has to be to go in there, survive, and come out of there with something that will help you earn a living and survive in a world that is run by stupid niggers, incompetent left-wing bitches, and fudge-packing faggots. Okay, let's see if I can get a little bit more specific. Again, bearing in mind that my experience is 4 decades out of date. Now, from 11th grade on, we had what was called modular scheduling, which was basically an elaborate system of no scheduling at all. which was, in turn, an elaborate scheme to camouflage the fact that the school administration had given up on any attempt to control the students' movements, i.e. the niggers' movements, on or off campus, and we were pretty much allowed to wander at will from that point on. Attendance at classes was pretty much optional by 12th grade. I don't know what it's like now. The system was pretty obviously collapsed by the time I graduated, and I imagine they figured out you have to at least have some way to herd these monkoids into class somehow if you're going to pretend that they're learning anything in graduating. Anyway, I educated myself, although not very well, by making two parts of the school my home base, the library and the chem lab. Now, our library at CHHS had two floors, and I found that if I was able to get in there and get whatever books I needed or wanted and get back into the stacks at one of the study carrels, I could pretty much hide from the madness and get on with getting into my head whatever I wanted to get into it. Now, the niggers would periodically come into the library, but they generally hung around downstairs at the tables and threw stuff at each other and booga booga boogaed until the librarian, Miss Peacock, who was one of the old-fashioned types from before integration, and she remembered the old ways. Anyway, she'd call the janitor and our assistant principal named Mr. Strickland, who was a large football player type, and they'd run the niggers out. Now, in those days, anyway, the niggers never actually resisted. This was 70 and 71, remember. Today, anyone trying to forcibly evict a nigger gang from a high school library in some schools would probably get a 9mm bullet for their trouble. I understand that some years later, Strickland was shot by one of his nigger students, but he survived, and he may even have become principal for a while, if memory serves. And when they were in the library, the monkoids almost never came up to the stacks, because there was nothing but books up there. Now, the chem lab was another place where only white male students hung out for obvious reasons. We had a kind of lunchtime group who gathered in there, and when we weren't playing pranks on the teacher, Mr. Smith, he was actually teaching us some real science. Now, we had one incident where a particularly bad nigger named Jojo blundered into the room and was threatening to assault one of my friends with his fists, but I scared him off with a flask full of sulfuric acid, which fortunately I didn't have to throw. I doubt if I could have talked my way out of that one. Jojo later attacked me after a school talent show in Carrboro where my younger brother was playing. Some years after that, when I was in Arlington, Jojo was sentenced to death for the rape and murder of a white girl that I'd known briefly at Chapel Hill High. She used to ride the same school bus as me from Orange County. He actually talked his way into her apartment, posing as a vacuum cleaner salesman, and he left her raped and dead on the floor. His sentence was commuted, and he's probably out of prison now. Unless he went back in later for another murder, which is likely. I've often wondered what would have happened if I'd thrown the acid and taken the fall myself back in 71, but I didn't. And I made it out alive and became the bright spark I am today. But Betsy paid with her life for my forbearance. The time may come, Jake, when you yourself have to make decisions like that. All I can say is that you can't be constantly second-guessing yourself and wondering what will happen, or you'll go cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. Your job is to survive and make it out of there, with some kind of education or skill that will allow you to make a living, preferably free of employment and a paycheck that they can cut off. Okay, third music break. Now, as beautiful as much Christmas music is, and as tempting as it is for me to play Stille Nacht, or maybe something by way of a Gregorian chant from the Eastern Orthodox Christmas service, I've been hunting around the internet for the Christmas carol or song which best expresses the American soul, if you will, the essence of the American experience during this greatest of all holidays. And as every year, there is only one possible choice.
Grandma got run over by a reindeer walking home from our house Christmas Eve. You can say there's no such thing as Santa, but as for me and Grandpa, we believe she'd been drinking too much eggnog, and we begged her not to go, but she forgot her medication and she staggered out the door into the snow. When we found her Christmas morning at the scene of the attack, she had hoof prints on her forehead and incriminating claws marks on her back. Grandma got run over by a reindeer. Walking home from our house Christmas Eve. You can say there's no such thing as Santa, but as for me and Grandpa, we believe. Now we're all so proud of Grandpa. He's been taking this so well. See him in there watching football, drinking beer and playing cards with Cousin Mel. It's not Christmas without Grandma. All the family's dressed in black. And we just can't help but wonder, should we open up her gifts or send them back?
Send them back!
Grandma got run over by a reindeer. Walking home from our house Christmas Eve. You can say there's no such thing as Santa, but as for me and Grandpa, we believe. Now the goose is on the table, and the pudding made of fig.
Ah!
And the blue and silver candles, that would just have matched the hair in Grandma's wig. I've warned all my friends and neighbors, better watch out for yourselves. They should never give a license to a man who drives a sleigh and plays with elves. Grandma got run over by a reindeer, walking home from our house Christmas Eve. You can say there's no such thing as Santa, but as for me and Grandpa, we believe.
Sing it, Grandpa!
Grandma got run over by a reindeer, walking home from our house Christmas Eve. You can say there's no such thing as Santa, but as for me and Grandpa, we believe.
Merry Christmas. Now, resistance in high school. I won't have to choose my words very carefully here. If you're like me, Jake, you can't just lie down and take it. You have to do something to resist the madness that's going on around you, even if only for your own self-respect and your own peace of mind. I get it, Jake. There is nothing worse than walking around all day in all that crap, believing in your own heart that you're a coward, knowing that you should be fighting it, but you're too scared. Now, you're young, you're full of beans, and even today, the young people of our race still don't take well to being shoved around. It's not in our genes. Again, I don't know what your specific situation is or what it's likely to become, but I know that it's likely to be much more serious than anything I ever face, so just a few general words of advice. Number one, no matter how bad things get, do not ever bring a gun to school, even if you have good reason to believe that this time they're waiting for you with murder in mind. You are white, son. And in this society, you have no right to self-defense. You are supposed to take your beat down like a good white boy should, cringe and cry for mercy, and then go crawling off and lick your wounds. That's what we're supposed to do, not defend ourselves, and damn sure not with a weapon where we might actually hurt one of nature's privileged, dark-skinned beings. None of us have any right to self-defense. Ask Carl Hand. Just getting caught with a weapon will ruin you for life, and a knife or a tear gas, something like that, is almost as bad as a gun, and if you have to use it, you're done. You will spend the rest of your life as a slave laborer in the monetized American prison system. Now, that's not what I meant when I said to find a marketable skill. Now, if you know for certain that this time they're probably going to try and kill you or beat you so badly that you'll be crippled for life, or drag you into a bathroom and butt-fuck you, which I understand is now kind of an African-American game in certain school subcultures, kind of like the knockout game on the streets, then you just don't go to school. Whatever excuse you have to use, you just don't go. Now, normally, Jake, I would never advise you to drop out of school, but if you know absolutely and for sure that if you keep on going to that school, there is going to be bloodshed, probably yours, then you drop out and you go to work at McDonald's flipping burgers and get your GED while you do. One statistic I would love to see, if there were ever any kept honestly in this foul country, would be how many white boys have dropped out of school and gone for GEDs because it was simply no longer physically safe for them in a racially integrated and diverse high school. As to other acts of monkey wrenching and guerrilla tactics, yes, there are things that you can do. I did. Frankly, I was a one-man resistance in my senior year, and I fucked up that school good and proper, along with certain left-wing liberal faculty members, in a number of ways. And no, I'm not going to go into detail, because if I do, some of you kids out there are going to do these things. And the FBI will kick my door at 6 o'clock in the morning and storm into my bedroom, shrieking like little girls at the top of their lungs, and stabbing at me with their rifle barrels, claiming that I incited some kid I never heard of to do something. And I will be placed on trial for corrupting America's youth, which I'd actually be proud to be charged with, since that's the actual charge that Socrates was convicted on and executed for. But I don't feel like swallowing any of Barry's hemlock at the moment. Anyway, enough. Nobody's listening to this, because all of you should be opening your presents under the tree, or getting drunk on eggnog, or chasing your children around out in the snow and watching them break all their new toys. Next week is our traditional year-end all-music show. But for now, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to you all. And Sasha Andaban, freedom.
Still is beating perfect.